Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week of the War Report. We have two very special guests today. They are making their first appearance on the War Report, and I hope it won't be their last, depending on what they think of me when the show is over, but we'll see. Our guests are from Chicago. They are teachers in Chicago. They are union members as well, social activists, social justice activists, I should say. And we're going to talk about what is going on in Chicago right now. There has been a successful call for a sort of job action, whether you want to call it a strike or what have you, for April 1st. Why April 1st? April Fool's Day. We'll find out about that. And this was overwhelmingly approved. So we have a lot to talk about with our two guests. Our guests are Katie Osgood and Ed Hershey. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't care who starts first, but Katie, since I talked to you earlier, let's you and I start in terms of what's going on in Chicago.
Well, sure. Like everywhere else in the country, our public education system is under attack. We have a lot of special circumstances in that right now we're being attacked both by our mayor and our governor simultaneously, both trying to defund the public education system, turn it into a privatized charter district, close down schools, attack unions, the whole spiel that we've seen all over the country. What's happening right now is that we are organizing with our fellow union members in the Chicago Teachers Union to stand up and fight back against these attacks. We are currently without a contract, and we've been involved with that contract fight for, I believe, over a year. Negotiations are going nowhere because our school district is broke on purpose. They want to be broke in order not to have to fund the things that we know that our students and our schools need. So we are recently, just this past Wednesday, our House of Delegates voted overwhelmingly, 80% vote, to do a one-day strike this coming Friday, April 1st. And we will be standing up for more revenue for the schools. We will be doing this action, importantly, with other unions and community groups throughout the city of Chicago that are all under the same sorts of attacks, so including university faculty unions, fast food workers, child care workers. You know, we're trying to work with some of the folks from that drive the buses and that drive our trains, and just people from all over, especially as our governor, Governor Rauner, simultaneously is defunding entire statewide services with a lack of budget. We have not had a budget in our state for over 8 months. So right now we're in this kind of crisis where it's affecting a vast majority of people in Illinois, and we're hoping that on Friday people will turn out and, you know, really say no more of this and shut down our city.
I would just add that, you know, we have Governor Rauner, who his agenda is to perform in Illinois what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin, what Snyder did in Michigan, which is to make Illinois a right-to-work state, but that the Democratic machine downstate, they're posing as friends of the union right now, they're posing against Rauner, but that they've been part of the Machiavellian agenda against public education for a bunch of the laws that restrict us were passed by the Democrats, that the pensions were done so. You'd asked earlier why April 1st. is basically it came out of the bargaining. Originally, the head of the school, the CEO, which it's called here, of our school system, Forrest Claypool, had proposed that they would take a 7% pay cut away from us, and that we'd first see that on the April 1st paycheck. And so the union started planning an action for that day and reaching out and trying to make something happen for that day. Now, actually, by openly threatening to strike, just saying that publicly to the media forced Claypool to back off. But the union decided to hold. We wanted to go a little bit on offense and to hold to that day and say we're not just going to accept. Claypool had also is imposing 3 furlough days on us, one of which was this past Friday, and so we said, well, if they're going to keep chipping away at us, we've gone through at least 3 or 4 rounds of layoffs. They've laid off hundreds of special ed teachers. They are not paying us our lane and step increases from the beginning of the year. And these are all small things, but we were saying we were going to do something rather than just let them chip away at us.
Wow, that's a lot. But Ed, let me just say something. You have just become one of my favorite people because you mentioned the Machiavelli agenda. Mm-hmm. That means either you have listened to the show in the past or you were listening to Deborah Emerson as she introduces the show. And that's my key thing, the Machiavellian agenda. So you're now one of my new best friends. Welcome.
Thank you.
You mentioned also what's happening in Detroit. I just left Detroit. I was there for almost an entire month looking at what was going on in Detroit and in Flint. Hopefully we all know about Scott Walker and your neighbor next door, Wisconsin. And I have always said in the past that Rahm Emanuel's agenda was to turn Chicago into a privatized education system. In order to do that, of course, he had to destroy the existing public school system, which he had been working hard at. Mm-hmm. And do you see what's going on there in Illinois, closer to what's happening in Wisconsin, since you brought this up, Ed, then, well, I think even Michigan is more like Wisconsin than Wisconsin is like Illinois. What do you think?
I think certainly the privatization agenda it's on their agenda in all of those places. Detroit, I think they have a system that's 35% or 40% charter schools at this point, and they have been pushing the charter school. Charter schools have been being pushed the last 15 years or so. So our union teachers here, parents here, started pushing back. I know Katie worked on that some this summer. Maybe she'll speak to that. I think the ruling class agenda is a little bit different for Chicago from Detroit in that. Even our governor's daughter went to a selective enrollment. He actually clouded his daughter into a selective enrollment school downtown in the city. The best schools in the state are public schools that are run in the city, and so I don't think they want to completely dismantle the public school system, but certainly in poor working class areas, in black areas of the city, that's what they've been doing. That's where the school closings have been concentrated, and that's where the charter schools have been concentrated as well.
Katie?
Yeah, I echo what Ed just said. I think the agendas overall are the same. I think the playbooks are just slightly different in different locales based on kind of local, how politics work there. Ed mentioned how we have a Democratic controlled, legislature and city council and stuff, but that changes the dynamics, but not the project itself, which is definitely still to privatize. Like Ed said, I also think it's really important to focus, and we in the CCU have been pushing this a lot, how it's a especially racist project because it does impact our black and brown students the most. I work at a school on the far south side of Chicago. It's nearly 100% African American, both in terms of our population and our staff. And we are definitely seeing kind of the brunt of a lot of these attacks, and how, you know, they don't want schools like ours to exist anymore. And we've seen mass flee, like a mass population, just exodus of people leaving not only the city of Chicago, but Illinois completely because of a lot of these policies making it impossible, to live. And, so people are actually, you know, leaving, looking, and that's intentional. You know, they're trying to rid the city of people that they've deemed, you know, undesirable in order to rebuild the city as, you know, for a wealthier, whiter, class of people. And that is something that we, you know, are fighting against.
That latter point is right out of the playbook, and it's also what is happening in Detroit.
Yeah.
They are simply trying to move out what I refer to as disposable population, mm-hmm. that they see that no longer have any value, commodified value, and mm-hmm. as they move those people out, they're seeking to gentrify the city, which is another new word for mm-hmm. but turning the city white again versus being a majority city. So there's still some very good striking similarities between Detroit and Chicago. And after all, they're only like 260 miles apart. And mm-hmm. by the way, I was born and raised in Detroit, but I spent, as I told you, Katie, a lot of time growing up in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. So I have some familiarity with what's mm-hmm. going on there. So one of the things that I'm talking about, why I wanted to have a show this Sunday with the Chicago group, last week or week before last, I had Michelle Gunderson on, and we talked about what I call the Chicago 16, the group that mm-hmm. occupied the Bank of America. So I know you guys know all about that. But one mm-hmm. of the things that
Katie is
I,
one of them. Katie is one of them.
Yeah, I was one of the 16. Mm-hmm.
Tell the people about it. I know everything about, but tell the people about what took place and then the judge sentencing.
Yeah, so we, in our fight for funding for our schools and for our city, we've been targeting and looking to see where the money is in our city. And we know that there is plenty of money in this city. And one of the biggest places to look, of course, is the banking industry. But we've, CPS has gone into these really bad deals with various banks. We're calling them the toxic swaps. They're just essentially these toxic deals where bankers kind of made out like bandits and are taking money directly out of the school system because of these bad deals. And so we are pushing CPS and Rahm Emanuel to renegotiate these horrible deals that had no right to be made in the first place, as they benefit the banks and not the children. So we were targeting Bank of America as one of the targets, one of the main players that is gone into these bad faith deals. And in order to pressure them, we occupied one of their bank branches while simultaneously there was a march and a rally happening outside led by the CTU. So again, it was to highlight the money that's here that we could go after. You know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars we could get from the banks, like just by going through this process of suing the banks and getting the money back, which other cities, by the way, have done, cities like Houston. They've actually gone through the process and gotten some money back. Instead of doing things like cutting our schools, we've had 4 budget cuts, as Ed mentioned, this past year, many layoffs. We have furlough days. Meanwhile, Claypool, head of CPS, is threatening. So, we did this action. We were arrested. Actually, 12 of us made it into the bank, and 4 of us, including myself, got shut out from the bank and were actually arrested outside of the bank. So we were slightly different groups. But, the 16 of us were arrested and, you know, for trespassing. So in order to highlight our cause.
And the judge, you went to court, was it last week, week before last?
Yeah, so the 12 that were arrested in the bank had their court date already. The 4 of us that were outside the bank have our court date coming up on the 31st. So we'll see if we have a similar verdict, which we probably will. They're making them, I think the verdict was that they have to do some community service or something like this. But Yeah, really, really silly. Just the whole thing, you know, the fact that they're going to arrest teachers, and the majority of us actually were special, or a number of us were special education teachers too, which I think because our students are the most vulnerable in the system, and we see the impact kind of the most clearly. We'll see what happens with our court date in just a few days.
Okay. You say, just something you just said in terms of the special ed student being the most vulnerable, but also seemingly across the country, special ed teachers as well.
Yeah.
Which is totally incongruent. As you just said, the most vulnerable population and the most needed of specialized teachers are seemingly the first one on the chopping block.
Absolutely. And I mean, all of the policies that are being put in place by this kind of neoliberal agenda include things like using standardized test scores and evaluation and using evaluation systems that basically just are a huge, you know, blow to anyone that teaches students that don't do well on those types of tests. And, of course, you know, I'm against all standardized testing, but I believe it's especially damaging for our kids with you know, disabilities and mental health issues. I actually, before I was a teacher at my current school, I was a teacher on a psychiatric unit here in Chicago. I actually worked in a psychiatric hospital, an inpatient unit. And during testing time, we would have kids brought in directly from testing sessions that had complete mental health breakdowns because of the nature of these tests. So they're causing serious harm and abuse that I don't feel like people are really acknowledging. They're just kind of the powers that be are brushing it aside like it doesn't matter. But we saw dozens of kids in my hospital alone, so I can only imagine what that looks like nationwide. The kids that have tried to hurt themselves or hurt others as a direct result of these tests. So
I don't know if either of you know that I've been traveling across the country on a project that I call The People's Story. And one of the main things that I'm seeking to do is to, one, document our stories, and by that I mean teachers, students, parents, community activists, sometimes politicians like school boards, all of us who I consider to be casualties of this war. Every war has casualties, and we are the casualties in this war. And I've talked extensively to the students and the teachers and parents that I've been able to document their stories in terms of the impact, the consequences of being waterborne and how it has affected them socially, psychologically, emotionally, financially, you name it. And what comes up so often is what you just said in terms of what I've also talked about on this show, the Hippocratic Oath. The first principle is first do no harm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But also says that the Machiavellian agenda, one of its principles is by any means necessary. And so to destroy public education and the teaching profession and they don't care about the harm that they're doing to students in general and particularly the special ed. So inhumane, in my view.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I just think it is, like you mentioned, like what they're, in their eyes, is a surplus population for them. So that, like, special ed students and students with high needs and people that are victims of the oppression and racism created by the society and take a lot of resources in order to serve, and they aren't, you know, their interest is not to continue paying for that. And so even though, these are high needs, but they've been trying, and in Illinois, they've repeatedly tried to, like, blow up different legal protections for, like, how many special ed students you can have in a class, and they're going to keep doing that. I think part of even the charters, I think, in general, a lot of college graduates right now are having difficulty getting jobs, and I think the ruling class is saying, like, we don't need to provide high, they don't see themselves as having an interest in providing a decent education to the working class, and therefore they're fine with spending less money on it, at which charter schools both give them a chance to spend less money on the students and to give more money to their friends or to contractors, and so it's sort of a win-win for them.
both of you hit it, I think, the nail on the head again, in that it's the bottom line. It's what Noam Chomsky says, profit over people.
Mm-hmm.
Special ed costs money. Special ed teachers cost money.
Right.
If you don't have to educate them, if you can find a way to get them out of your system, be it the public or the private, that has an impact on the bottom line. And I think we have really, really emphasized that point enough for the whole public that we're talking about, the 50-plus million students that we have in our public education, well, in our education system, their parents and et cetera. When you see people treating the special ed students the way they have been treated and are being treated, it is so inhumane. And you have to say, like, at some point, I would hope, why? Why in the hell are they doing this?
Right.
And both
and
of you hit the nail on the head.
Yep. I mean, and a lot of it, like you said, it's hidden from a lot of people because all you hear is the rhetoric and the narrative around, oh, well, we want better schools and, oh, we want, you know, we want better teachers. And that's like this whole narrative that they actually say, but what they actually do is the opposite of that, right? And there's real consequences for real people.
Absolutely. That do the opposite of what you say is right out of Orwell's 1984.
Mm-hmm.
The double C.
Yeah. Yes.
Here's a point that I have been making. I've been on the air 2 years now, going on 2 years and 1 month. And almost from the very beginning, what I'm about to say is what I've been saying constantly. That what happens in Chicago with the CTU is a potential precedent, a model for the rest of the teachers' unions, be it local, national, or state or national, to follow. In my view, you guys have become the model of unionism, the model of progressive social justice activism. And do you, within the union yourselves and both of your union members, do you ever give any thought to that in terms of the whole world, kind of education world, is looking at what you guys do and that what you do may become precedent for what others will or should be doing?
That's certainly been part of the discussion. Even at a certain point, there was a deal, you know, that a lot of the teachers really didn't want. And not only did they see this deal was bad for us, but they also said, look, you know, we are known nationally for fighting and for even drawing, for pushing. We've still been pushed back even with our strike, you know, but that we made a strike in the face of a Democratic mayor during election season, that we made, you know, a much bigger fight than we've seen in other places, and that it's important that, like, if we were seen giving in or giving up concessions in the contract, that, you know, would be a setback not just for us, but for all, you know, all unions and all of public education. And so we definitely are, you know, we're very cognizant that we're, I guess, one thing, you know, I was very happy that our strike was in 2012, which was about a year after Wisconsin in 2011, and that we got to be the sequel to that. What we would like to see more of, I mean, we have seen other teachers' unions starting to follow our example, but we would like to see a bigger pushback and a bigger fight back against this agenda on the part of unions, on the part of everyone, and on the part of working people in general.
Right. Okay. And I think, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to echo what Ed was saying. I mean, we definitely know that folks are looking to us. You know, I think that's part of the reason why we're kind of ratcheting up what our actions are. You know, We are, like, the strike we're doing on April 1st, is this type of strike has never been done in Illinois before. We have very strong legal grounds, and we know that we're allowed to do this action, but, you know, it's never been done, so this particular type of unfair labor practice strike in our state. So, you know, there was some discussion, you know, like, what does that mean for our union? But we kind of, I think people in the end, even though it was a little bit scary, they're like, we have to go the next step. The same thing with, you know, starting to take a rest. Like, we're starting to see that we need to push it up to the next level in order to really get the kind of changes that we need. The ruling class is not going to let us just, you know, give us what we need. They're not going to just say, oh, here's your money. I'm sorry. We had it over here, but we'll give it to you now. You know, we actually have to demand it. And we, you know, we talk a lot. Like, I know there's a lot of our rank and file folks talking with other rank and file folks across the country. You know, what can we do? A lot of teachers I've met have said, what can we do to, you know, do what Chicago's been doing? And there's a lot of work being done to, you know, reform within each local, you know, trying to push for those, you know, a local that's going to fight for everyone, of, you know, that social justice unionism. So it's very, you know, I definitely am very proud to be part of the CTU and what we're doing here. And I hope it does give others some hope.
Well, I can only say maybe two things, maybe three words. You guys are so cool.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, really, you are. You're doing what I'm from. Like I said, I'm from Detroit, and I grew up during the time when the automobile unions were going through a lot of what we were going through in education, and we had very, very bold leadership coming out of Detroit that did the striking, did everything, and took the blows, and you name it, but remained very aggressive on the part of the workers. And in Detroit, Walter Reuther, who I don't know if people would know that name or not, but who was head of the labor union in Detroit, the automobile side, he even went as far as helping desegregate Detroit. When I started elementary, kindergarten, Detroit was integrated. This was years before the 1954 Supreme Court decision. Buses, food counters, and et cetera. This was unionism that I saw. My father was a union person, and I grew up in that type of union. And then when I started college and into graduate school, and teachers were getting clobbered all across the country, did not see teachers standing up, resisting, fighting back. I haven't seen it during the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and then boom, you guys bring it all back. And what you've done starting in, was it 2010 and going forward?
When the core caucus came to power?
Yes. My hat is more than off to you guys. I sing your praises every time I have an opportunity to do so. And speaking of something you just said also, Katie, I was at United Opt Out a couple weeks ago in Philly, and listening to other teachers, and Michelle was there, and others, Chicago, you guys are the big brothers, the big sisters to all the other unions. They look up to you, and yes, it's like in a family. You watch your older brothers and sister, and what they do, you try and do as well. That's it. You guys are just so damn cool.
I mean, but we do. I mean, at this point, though, really, like, I would love to see teachers just around the country, and I know there's so many people out there that are ready and wanting to fight and understand the issues, but actually kind of taking the next step of actually starting to shut stuff down and doing the riskier actions that we actually need to do. And it's hard and it's scary, and you're right, no one's been doing it for the past 30 years under, you know, like from like Reaganomics on, right? You know, I mean, and that was intentional, right? There was a tax on our unions. There was a tax on working people. We saw a decrease in our standard of living across that entire time. And I think people are reaching their breaking point and saying, this is unsustainable. I can't live like this. I can't make it anymore. Like, people that were working class or, you know, are falling down below the poverty line now. And we, you know, I think we're in a moment where people theoretically across the country, maybe even across the globe, could start to like push back, and that would be, you know, that would be super exciting.
Well, you hit it when you said back to Reaganomics in 1980. Before he got into office, that was one of his pledges, that he would break the union, and he did with TACO, the air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
I'm sure that scared the shit out of a whole lot of unions across the country. I think that set the table for, especially in the automobile unions, to start giving concessions left and right, and have been doing it for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe you guys were showing the unions, not only just in education, which is desperately needed in my view, I mean beyond desperately needed. I have often been so frustrated with teachers back in the 60s, as I said, going forward, that I named teachers the three S's. No, people, not those three S's. My three S's are sheep, sheared, ready for slaughter. We just roll over, and at the K through 12, as well as the university level. Most of my teaching, almost 90% of my teaching, was at the university level. You're talking about a group of people, they wouldn't even say the word union, let alone unionizing, when I was a professor. And it's horrible in my view.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You don't want me to start talking about that.
Well, I think part of it, though, is like in this action for Friday, two of the biggest actors outside of CTU are going to be communities, professors and students at Chicago State and Northeastern Illinois University, which, because they haven't gotten their state appropriation to this point, because they're Chicago State University is a school that serves the South Side. It prepares a big chunk of Chicago's teachers. People go there to get people go there for social work degrees. It's a school that's close to home. I have an alumnus who graduated recently. She started at Illinois State, but her mom got sick, and so she transferred to CSU in order to be closer to home. This school is not a rich school. It serves Black people on the South Side primarily. And so it doesn't have a huge endowment, and so it's threatened with, because not getting its state appropriation means it may shut down before the end of the year. And so that's, you know, the professors' union is, you know, they're sort of faced with like life or death with this thing. And so that they're coming out, that's why they're coming out with us. And Northeastern is in a similar boat. UIC had a strike 2 years ago, not a long one, but, you know, they have the attack on public schools has been taking place at the public universities too, where they've been pushing towards, you know, the same thing they've been pushing for in the working class, which is like, you know, trying to get temp labor at lower cost, where a big chunk of professors now are adjunct faculty who are much lower cost, rotate, don't even really make a living wage. And so I think we are at that point, and it's exciting to be able to, like, you know, their state crisis is part of our state crisis. We also need more money from the state.
Right.
And so it's good to coordinate our fight this way.
Which is why the April 1st action, I think, has the potential to be, I mean, I don't know what it's going to end up looking like, but it has the potential to really tap into all of these different struggles happening. You know, recently Chicago, a bunch of, you know, activists shut down a Trump rally, and we've had a lot of, you know, Black Lives Matter activists, you know, doing lots of, you know, great work. We've had, you know, we shut down our Magnificent Mile shopping, like the biggest shopping area, on Black Friday, which is, you know, the day, the biggest shopping day of the year, you know, and we stood arm in arm in front of stores and didn't let people shop, which, you know, hurts the people, you know, hurts the commerce. That's like, you know, you don't touch our money kind of thing. Actually got people to notice. So, you know, I think all these struggles are happening. We've got, you know, people fighting for so many different parts of the same beast, you know, and I have this what we're hoping is that this April 1st brings everybody out into one place so we can look at each other and say, look how many of us there are, you know, and really make the people that the ruling class shake in their boots. Like, we want them to be afraid of our power, because we do actually have more power than they have. They have money, we have people, and people can trump money as long as we use their power.
I wanted to say something to you earlier when you and I talked about what was going on. I have also been talking about, there's a theory that was put out by two people. One was at University of Colorado, Colorado University. And these two people, they did a longitudinal study in terms of going back over maybe 100, 150 years. They were looking at social movements. And what they were looking at was peaceful social movement versus violent social movement, and which one was the most successful. And according to their analysis, it was the peaceful social movements that won out more often than the violent ones. And what they postulated was that, from their work, was that when you get 3.5% of the population supporting your movement, and in this case, in America, when we have a 315, 60, 17 million population, you're talking about 11.5 million people. In Chicago, I don't know what the city population is, but take whatever that is and 3.5%. If you can get 3.5%, then those movements that achieve that 3.5% were far more likely to succeed in terms of achieving their goals than those movements that utilize violence as a means of trying to achieve their goals. So what you guys are doing, of course, and have been doing, is trying to bring that coalition, as you said, the various entities that have different things at stake here, but it all falls under the same umbrella. Yes, if you can achieve this, I mean, you're already an icon, but you become truly, truly a national, probably a global icon, in that I know from my talks to people in Europe and in other countries, they're able to get what you're seeking to get. To get people from all walks of life joining a one-day strike or a week, whatever the length of strike is, to show. Well, just like recently in Brazil, where you had 3 million people in the street. That's what you're seeking for, and that's what we need. And if you guys can pull it off, I sure in hell hope the rest of us, be whatever walk of life we're in, will take heed and say, if they can do it, we can do it. I think it was yesterday or today, there was a piece that Michelle Gunderson wrote that appeared in Anthony Cody's blog. And which basically, I took it to say that it's one of the great displays of union democracy. She was explaining how you guys went through, the delegates, 500 plus of you, went through this process to arrive at approving a strike vote. Take people through that for us.
Well, I'd say actually, I think we'd want to go before the House of Delegates meeting. The union had said to keep, you know, we had originally planned to go out on strike when they were talking about cutting our pay for that April 1st. So they were already, that was when we were going to go out on strike. And then they backed off of the pay raise. The union said to keep it open. They were working on organizing it. They announced it. And then what happened was there's a long process, close to 2 weeks, of activists and delegates talking about the action in their schools. And like Katie mentioned before, the one-day strike hasn't been... I know teachers in Washington have done it in their fight for state funding last spring, but it's not something too many teachers in Chicago had heard about. And so it was a new idea, and so people were somewhat uneasy about it. And so the delegates at school, the union leaders, union activists, they, you know, we were having discussions in basically every school for weeks, more than a week, and then leading up to this House of Delegates meeting. And so then there were the vote totaled a little, just over 600 votes at that House of Delegates. So that's like, and there are about 600 schools. So probably almost every school in the district was represented at that meeting. And then people came in, and the leadership from the floor of the House of Delegates, they had their remarks. The leaders, the elected leaders all spoke to why they thought the action made sense. And then they opened for discussion and allowed, you know, delegates to come to mics and express their feelings. A lot of people, you know, even people who had staffs that were uncomfortable said that. And some people, you know, there were people who said, we like this. There were people, there were some schools that said, we should just be going out now. And there are other schools which were less comfortable with it. And they let the discussion go. Even the leadership wanted to extend the discussion. And there was a move from the delegates to say, no, we've, you know, there's a sense among the delegates, people assembled, we've heard from people. We'd heard most of the arguments about twice at that point after about half an hour, 45 minutes of discussion. And then we took the vote. It wasn't, from the people that spoke, it wasn't real clear how the vote was going to go. The leadership had said, we want at least two-thirds of a vote in order for this to pass because we need to be united if this is going to be effective. And when people, they took a standing vote when we did it, and it looked like about 80%. They then did what's called division of the House, where they had all the no votes and the yes votes separate so that they could count exactly. They were saying, we want to make sure we have this counted exactly because this is a pretty important issue, and it came out to almost exactly 80% for. So
right. That and
was,
I think that, you know, the normally when you take a vote in the House, it's just 50% plus one vote. That's how you pass something, right? But I think it was important that the people, both in the leadership and rank and file, moved and supported doing a two-thirds passing for this particular motion because they knew it had been controversial. And definitely our union is not perfect when it comes to democracy, but it's the best I've seen any organization do in this sort of thing, even though it's messy and complicated and it doesn't always end up being right. But yeah, so I think it was actually pretty moving to go, you know, to watch this process play out. I think there are probably more union meetings in the past 2 weeks in the city of Chicago than like maybe some areas have had like ever, you know, because I mean, this really got people talking and discussing and debating, and delegates showed up, you know, it was a huge meeting. It was very full. And you know, people had a chance to speak out, a lot of people, not everybody, and kind of share where they're coming from. And, you know, I thought it was pretty powerful. I was number 340 for the action. So, yeah, it was interesting seeing how democracy actually can work sometimes, I hope.
Well, I'm going to repeat what I said. This doesn't happen from, again, I have been a unionist for a long, long time. I'm always ready and willing to look to see what's happening as it relates to our unions, because the union was so very important to my family and my life. So I'm still, I consider myself a union baby. I've always said that I'm way beyond being a baby, folks. We all know that. But that's mm-hmm. how I've described myself. But going across the country, the states that I've gone to and the cities that I've gone to over the last 4, 5, 6 months, one of the things that I hear consistently, and especially from the parents, was that, where are the unions in helping us fight against the privatization? Where are the unions? I even heard that from teachers saying that their unions were not present. They're at the local, at the state, or at the national level. And I've just been one of my criticisms for the longest of time. And even very recently, you talked about, I say, you know, a model of democracy, what was described and by Michelle and reported in Anthony Cody's blog. You don't see that in Detroit mm-hmm. most recently. Yeah. They make a mockery out of democracy. You look at what's happening. I know you guys are ATF, and I'll say what I always say. There's no blanking democracy in ATF. Mm-hmm. There's no democracy in NEA at any levels mm-hmm. that I've seen. Out and out dictatorship. Even go back as far as saying that the unions were set up in such a way that those who were initially in power will always stay in power. And I've seen that happen, at least reports and talking to people who have attended as delegates to AFT meetings and elsewhere, where the national comes in with 600 delegates, where everyone else comes in with a handful.
Yeah.
So right away, you know what's going to happen at that conference. What's happening in Chicago is such a breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
But just to speak on breath of fresh air out of Detroit, because I know, you know, what you're talking about with AFT in Detroit, DFT in Detroit, where they removed a democratically elected president even after
Steve,
a vote.
They moved Steve.
Yeah, but that the, you know, we in Chicago and Katie and I and people who've been paying attention to Detroit, you know, they got a lot of attention with that sick out campaign recently. And that even though the apparatus there removed the president, still people organized, actually he was not the president, but he was largely implicated in helping to organize that sick out, which took on the character, you know, at one point 90% of the schools were out for a day from that. And so that when teachers, when working people are ready to fight, they can go past the bureaucracies that are imposed on us and figure out a way mm-hmm. to do it. And they clearly did there in Detroit, mm-hmm. at least with that sick out thing. And
yeah.
Well, the national AFT first yep. sent some of their people to try and get the teachers to not do the sick out.
That's
and then
right.
Randy herself mm-hmm. came there
yeah.
to try and persuade people not to do the sick out.
Right.
So
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But things were, I mean, people, we all saw the videos of, like, what they were sicking out for, and it's like, you know, they were at a breaking point where they're like, this cannot go on. What, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
Absolutely.
And I do think that speaks to, like you were saying about organizing, like, you know, over the summer, I worked with the CTU. They have a summer internship program where they have people, they have regular rank and file members go door to door and do actions, and they actually pay us a stipend for the summer to do this work. And I think for me, it was a very important, experience, because it actually focused in on those individual, like, relationships that you build with people in your building or in your area or your, you know, people that you know. And how you actually organize people one-on-one. Like, it's not like, you know, the leadership's going to do what they're going to do, but if we're actually doing the work of, and you know, and I'll tell you, in leading up to this vote in the House of Delegates, I mean, I felt like Ed was on the phone every other, like, minute talking to people at his school, like, you know, writing emails, like, discussing, like, you know, and that actually takes a lot of, each person doing the work of organizing around them and having conversations and not just saying you all should be doing this, but actually listening to people and what are your concerns and, you know, how does that tap into what, you know, what we could do as a union and the power we could have. And I think that's just it's hugely important for teachers that feel like they have nothing, you know, no way that they see what's wrong and they don't know what to do. But just starting with those, like, you know, that's how CORE began, was just a group of 10 teachers that were, like, fed up with all the nonsense in the union and the lack of democracy and, you know, the lack of doing anything against these attacks. And they just got together and they started having conversations, and it kind of grew out of that, right? So I think that's important.
And actually, yeah, to speak, because you mentioned earlier, like, the union's not doing that much around charters, privatization. I mean, CORE, the initial impetus for CORE was the main organizer for CORE was at a school that got closed, and the union's advice was that he should prepare, get his resume ready. And then,
yeah.
you know, there were, the thing about the school closings and charter schools became the two main issues the caucus organized around, because, like, every time CPS would close a school, that would be, you know, maybe some schools, this community was so demoralized that they didn't put up a fight, but at least half of the communities, like, rallied, and the union wasn't doing anything about that. And so, but because that, you know, the school closing was this traumatic attack that encouraged people to organize, and CORE, as a caucus within the union, was able to basically coordinate those and make that into a fight that started,
Like, the mayor we had before, Daley, didn't like to look like he was mean to the community. Emmanuel doesn't really care. But Daley didn't like it when people would push back on him that way. And so, actually, they were pretty effective pretty quickly at, you know, helping to organize people in those school, those closing schools communities. And when they pushed back, a lot of those schools got taken off the list. And a lot of those schools stayed open. And because the previous leadership was so undemocratic, even a relatively small group was able to get elected into the leadership pretty quickly just because the previous leadership was so discredited. They basically, like, fell apart. And then, you know, we had some people who were, like, dynamically raising the issues. I think another thing that hasn't been duplicated yet is, I don't follow the national union scene as closely as I might, but I haven't seen people, you know, another city that's put the, you know, clear opposition to the charters and closings on the agenda as clearly as CORE has. But they're hopefully they're coming.
Yes.
Well, I think they're out there. Like, there's definitely caucuses that are start. Like, you know, it's the WE caucus in Philadelphia, for example. Definitely, I think that in the MORE caucus, they've definitely entered that. But
But they're not running their unions yet.
No, they're not running the union. They have not gotten. That's true.
Yeah.
No, but you reach 2 points. I said the reason, and again, who am I? I'm not in Chicago, but I think the reason that you were so successful externally in the first strike 5 years ago was because you took the social justice platform. You took away the historical argument of teachers being just some greedy people. You only work 4 or 5 hours a day. You get these vacations for Christmas, for this, that, and the other. You get the summer off. You get paid sick leave. You get all of this. You're just a bunch of greedy folks. You took that away when you start talking about classroom conditions, when you start talking about the things that are affecting the students. Then you got the parents' attention. The parents then got their neighbors' attention. So when you guys took to the street, you had so many community people behind you, unlike any other probably time in recent memory. That, to me, was mind-blowing, but the cause of it was that you were capable of saying, we are striking because of things beyond just what will be our own professional interest, our personal interest. We're striking for things that affect the student. If they affect us, then they affect the student's learning. And that, to me, has been your most salient, smart move. And again, you may not agree with that, but that was huge.
I would agree with that. I think we definitely won. As far as, like, working class public opinion in the city, my school was in West Englewood. It wasn't uniform around the whole city. It's just a lot of their wealthier parts of the city. But, like, when we were marching around on strike in West Englewood or in Back of the Yards, which are both working class communities on the south side, relatively poor, we had overwhelming, you know, people would just see us on the street. At one point, we were sort of going door to door just to see what people felt. And people were on our side. Mayor Emanuel made it really easy. The way Mayor Emanuel came at us, I think he had people who sort of researched the points you're talking about where there had been, like, a community versus teacher union divide that he thought he could get parents to go against the teachers. And he quickly learned otherwise, that that was not going to play and that that didn't play. And that we, and in fact, the board this time, I can't tell you how many letters they've tried to send home to parents this time around, because they're trying with all their might to try to get parents to be on their side. Mm-hmm. Even though, I mean, just to tell you a little flagrant hypocrisy that even the newspapers have picked up on. So we had this furlough day last Friday, and we have this strike this Friday. So they're doing everything they want. They're saying, like, oh, if teachers cross the picket line, we'll pay you. Please come to work. And then for parents, they say, hey, we're going to have a bunch of places open so your student is safe. But then the newspaper asks them, well, what about last Friday? You're not concerned about student safety right. in any of that last Friday. You just closed everything down. And Claypool didn't have an answer. You know, it's very... They said Claypool didn't answer.
Right. I'm aware that we're going to have parks and libraries and other safe places for the students to mm-hmm. come. And, yes, we're going to support those teachers who cross the picket line and parents who will bring their yeah. kids to the safe spots that we will designate. Yes, hypocrisy.
Right. And then that was none of that for last Friday, which they imposed on families the same. So,
One thing that I definitely want us to get to, and that is laying out the big picture as well as the micro and the macro issues that you guys are facing. Because as I think you were the one who said it, Ed, and then I know, Katie, you have said it a couple of times. When the public understand, or first of all, they become aware of all the issues, the bigger picture, then when you can then bring that awareness to a level that I call critical awareness, setting the stage for understanding and raising that understanding to critical understanding, that's when the other side, who have all the money in the world, are the most vulnerable. It's mm-hmm. when the people are aware and truly understand all of the issues. And I'll start off with your governor. It's no secret that he wants to take over Chicago Public Schools at the state level, out of the hands of Emmanuel, but into the hands, like Snyder in Michigan has done. That's a huge issue that the public definitely needs to be aware of, and you guys need to be hammering that home. But there are other issues. Let's kind of lay out a litany of the issues that if the people are aware of and understand, they're going to be on our side. I'm adding myself to your team. They'll be on our side, and we're mm-hmm. going to be very successful in getting the public support. I know the budget issue, not passing a budget.
Yes.
From the governor's office.
Right.
Anything else happening at the state level?
I mean, I just think it's the budget really right now is the biggest thing, and it's all the ways that it manifests itself. So, like, you know, where we've had mental health services shut down. There's, like, a Lutheran services, I believe, like, lost a ton of funding. We lost... you know, it's the home health care workers and child care workers that, and so now suddenly people are, you know, scrambling because those services are being, you know, just denied. And, I mean, there's so many others. But I think, I'll let Ed see if he has some other stuff statewide.
Oh, DCSS workers and people who do mm-hmm. all sorts of the human services, you know, transportation for the elderly. All sorts of things have been cut and, you know, and are starting, like, there was just a story in the newspaper the other day about this home health care worker who stopped getting paid, and he was not being paid a living wage to begin with and couldn't make ends meet, but he's taking care of a person who cannot move themselves and who's living with their grandmother who can't move him. And so he's still going to work. The story is this guy is not getting paid. He's doing necessary work we need done in the society, and they're just not paying him. And they, you know, it's a pretty disgusting game because basically, you know, the Democrats and Rahner in Springfield have been pushing things to a crisis and are trying to, you know, use this budget game of chicken that comes at the expense of working of a huge swath of the working population in the state, all for their political machinations of who's going to be the top dog in Springfield and get to run things. And it's, you know, we get to point that out, and we're pointing that up and saying, like, you know, but yeah, that's what's happening.
Well, you have that dimension. And then of course, back to the city itself, Emmanuel's privatization agenda that he came in with, and has been from day one trying to push not only privatizing public education but other elements of it. What was it, the parking meters that backfired on him?
And that was under Daley, but...
Oh, yeah, Daley, mm-hmm. but he... Okay, go ahead.
Oh, just the main deal happened under Daley, and it was such a bad deal. It was an illegally bad deal, and Emanuel... My understanding is Emanuel more or less just ratified the deal and did a little bit of legal digging and, like, did some mild adjustments that actually ended up being worse for people. You know, they lengthened the hours and gave people Sunday off or something, and then yeah. left the deal in place. And even by the time Emanuel had come in, basically all the money the city had squandered all the money they got out of that deal, which was about half or something of what it was worth. You know, the amount of money that company, LAZ, is going to, which is a subsidiary of a gigantic bank, is going to make off his parking. It's like a 75-year lease. They get to just pull money out of the city. Yeah.
Well, that and, again, the privatization of education and other probably elements of the city, that's your main argument. People, when they realize what privatization is and what it entails, most people don't want to be privatized. They don't want their services and themselves to become privatized. But that's exactly what is the ultimate goal of both your governor and your mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Privatization works for the few, not for the many. And I think people understand that. You know, we've seen it in the housing as well. You know, we've seen in mental health services and health services. We've seen it in education. You know, we've seen it in so many different ways how privatizing things makes it less accessible, less people can, you know, get those services that they need. You know, the idea that, you know, you're, whether or not you can afford health care is going to determine whether you get health care, not just as a human right, you know. So, and, you know, and Manuel's been pushing on all those fronts. You know, we have you know, he shut down a bunch of mental health clinics in our city, right as like we have mental health crises and people need those services and they just don't exist anymore.
And you know how the playbook works. You seize on any crisis. You never let a good crisis go to waste.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get a natural crisis, then you manufacture a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, oh, Definitely. It's so bad. You see how the public is responsible for this. The only solution is going to be to privatize.
Yep.
So you set up the crisis, then you proclaim who are responsible for it, but you also proclaim who can best solve the crisis going forward. And so, again, the public, every opportunity, and again, these are my views, every opportunity that we can, we need to show how they're coming from that agenda that I call the Machiavellian agenda, that playbook of how to eventually privatize everyone and everything. And mm-hmm. it just happens to be, education just happens to be, it happened to be our turn now. The post office has had, they're whacking the post office, you guys already know this, and the public should by now, they're whacking the post office. They've been trying to whack Medicare and Social Security forever under Republican and Democratic presidential holders. And it's just, it's now gotten to be so blatant that mm-hmm. we can't take it for granted that the public is not aware of where they're coming from, what their ultimate goal is here. And what you guys are doing, again, pointing out what's happening on the education front is worth more than its weight in gold than anything. Because, again, all the eyes are watching Chicago and what mm-hmm. you guys do. So you've got to keep it up. And you've got to have this march, the strike, come Friday, and then be ready to negotiate that great contract for yourself as opposed to taking the concessions that I'm sure they're trying to push on you and mm-hmm. say, you need to carry the burden of our debt crisis that we
mm-hmm.
made. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, they want us to pay for their crisis. That's certainly their plan.
Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you guys want to touch on? We have the time.
No. I mean, there's still a lot to say, of course, but right now we're just kind of gearing up for our April 1st action, and then kind of to also keep in mind that that's not where it ends, right? We still have our, like you said, our contract fight. We are gearing up, and what we expect could be a prolonged strike once there's a timeline that the state has imposed on unions here that we must follow. And once that timeline has played out, that we still may need to fight, very likely may need to be on a prolonged strike, not a one-day strike, in order to get what we need. But I do think that this action, fighting for revenue, you know, is immensely important, because we can't get what we need if they keep, you know, claiming broke on everything, even though, you know, it's a manufactured crisis. So, so that's kind of what's, it's a long fight, but like you said, we can't give up at this point. Like, there's no going back.
Well, you're the leader, and hopefully you'll lead us and the rest of the country will follow you. Ed, is there something you wanted to add?
I mean, just that I agree with what you said earlier. I think part of the broader agenda is, you know, you mentioned they went after other public services. They went after the auto workers. The ruling class and corporations, you know, we've been in this sort of, like, not growth period since that last collapse, and the ruling class is looking for money anywhere they can get it. And there's this huge pool of money that's penned up in public education, and they're trying to, like, suck that out of the system any way they can, and charter schools let them do that. And they're doing a creeping privatization of nursing at the school in CPS right now. They contracted out all the custodial management, which has made the schools a lot. I mean, people, you know, parents in my school and parents all over the city just see, oh, bathrooms are, you know, you've changed the managers, you laid off people actually do the cleaning, you've brought on a bunch of extra management people, and you're padding the bottom line for Aramark, this multinational corporation. And it's no surprise that means the bathrooms our students use are filthier. And, you know, they're trying to do anything they can to get their hands on the money that our students need, and that we have to do anything we can to try to push in the other direction, both on our own account, but, like, you know, we got everybody to strike last time, but we succeeded maybe at least a little bit, is to, like, get other people to come out with us with this one-day action, and maybe that'll lay the groundwork. You know, the transit companies, transit union and the state workers union, both have complaints with the mayor and the governor, the same as we do, and their contracts are up. And so it's, you know, this could get bigger. And, Katie, you know, maybe this will get bigger. So here's hoping to that.
Two things. One, I don't know if you know it, but my primary thing is I'm anti-privatization. What I call the goal of the privatization of everyone and everything, humanity and the planet. That's the end game here. And when I say privatization, you should think ownership and control. That's where we're headed if we don't, you know, fight back successfully. And also, the money. I've said this a million times, Ed. I've read many times where the estimated expenditure for education in this country, pre-K to PhD, is not the $500 to $700 billion that people quote all the time. It's much more like $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in this country. Globally, $7 trillion. And think about this. If you could get total control of that kind of money,
that's
without dropping one bomb, without one pair of boots on the ground, without one tank rolling in, without one plane flying over, wouldn't you take it? That is their attitude. Mm-hmm. Rupert Murdoch said, what, maybe 5 years ago, when he said there was $500 billion on the table, that they're basically asking us to take it.
Yeah.
That was his attitude several years ago. And that has been the foundation, I believe, of what we're seeing going on here, is ultimately the total privatization of public education, with the probably exception of a few, quote, old-style public schools that will take the special needs students, the students that who are ruled to be, their conduct is unacceptable in the privatized yeah. system, and those students who don't conform.
Yeah.
That's what we will end up with.
Right. And I think, bringing up students, and I think something we haven't touched upon yet is the power of students to organize and fight back themselves against these things. I know Ed has been, he's a high school teacher. He works very closely with a lot of student groups that are organizing and that are actually, they're taking it in their own hands. Like, teenagers saying that, we're not standing for this anymore. We're not going to let them just destroy our public schools. So I think that's been pretty powerful. I know in Chicago that's been a big sort of inspiration for all of us. And I hope that that movement also grows and that more kids get involved.
That's good news. Ed, enlighten us, because all of last year, my first year on the air, I was able to get in touch with and maintain constant contact with the students in Newark, student union in Newark. And I tried very hard to get that group to talk to a group of kids in Philly. And my hope was that to get those two talking, then we could try and talk to students all across the country, both at the high school level and the college level, because therein lies our real, real power. And so much so that I often remind people, it was Stalin who said, "He who controls the curriculum controls the future." And it was Hitler who chimed in and started the Hitler's Youth. And you know from your history what role they played in even turning in family members, parents, uncles, cousins, neighbors, who they were brainwashed into thinking that if you didn't and weren't going to serve the Reich, you were the enemy of the Reich. Well, the other side here, the 1%ers, if you want to collectively call them that, they know that. And you can look at how they've thrown out history. Very few districts teach civics about government anymore, let alone the arts and the humanities. So that they're trying to not only privatize the school, but also privatize the education so that they can privatize our youth, so that they will be the people who will help perpetuate their, what I call, the new Reich into the 1,000 years that they seek to. You guys have had to listen to me on the show to know what I'm talking about, because these are the things that I've been talking about over the last couple of years. But Ed, tell us about what's happening there on the student front, because I have not heard a lot about that.
So you mentioned, I've been working on student activism since Emanuel's school closing campaign. We had a student group at my school, probably touched 15 to 25 students at my school who were active at some point or another that year, both in coming out of the strike, but then in the struggle against these school closings. We basically had a group then, which was we had similar organizations at 6 or 7 high schools, and there's a youth-based community group that worked with us, and we were, I had some experience that year, but then this year there's been frequent, reasonably massive high school student rallies
against budget cuts. It's touched this year, like they've had like this big budget cutting, and sometimes it's touched particular schools. So you had walkouts at certain schools. We had a walkout at my school when the CEO visited our school. He was greeted with a student walkout and a student sit-in that day. Several Friday rallies, both in the fall and in spring. One day was a boycott where several hundred students didn't go to school, where they surrounded the Board of Ed meeting, where they've demonstrated at the state building, and they will be participating in the event on April 1st, this Friday, including a number of the school students I worked. We had a small, it was a student and teacher Bank of America rally. Katie talked about the toxic swaps earlier. We had about 20 people from my school, about half 10 teachers, 10 students, march to the neighborhood Bank of America and occupied their foyer for a little bit, saying, you know, you got to return this toxic swap money to the schools and stop taking our money for our students' education that just goes to your bottom line. And a number of the students have picked that up. They're saying in general, stop cutting our schools, but then they've been saying things, you know, there's different places that the city government could get money, and they're hammering on those as well as just expressing outrage that they're going to cut their education. There's a number of the selective enrollment schools downtown which have been the lead, and Lincoln Park, where they had a lot of student organization 3 years ago as well. And so they had easy access to downtown, and so they've been sort of the core of getting people to those downtown things. But then there's been other schools which had, you know, school-specific actions. This Far South Side High School had an action where they booked the highway for a little bit, I-94, one of the biggest in the country. And so there's been a lot of student activity. And one of the things we're hoping to see is that out of that, we can develop a more built-out student organization similar to what they have in Philadelphia and Newark.
Oh, you bring a big, huge smile to my face. That is so good to see or to hear about. And I will just say what I said before. If we can succeed in getting other teachers' unions and individual teachers involved on a national level like you guys are doing, if we can get students like you guys seem to be getting now, if we can get the parents, we can get our 11, 12, 13 million people to go up against the power elite. There's absolutely no reason why we can't do this. Well, let me also say what I've been saying for the last 2 years. I talk about this like geometric circle sort of thing, that supposedly we have something like 5 million, well, maybe union teachers or 5 million teachers. What if every teacher had at least one significant other? That would make it 10. What if one parent, now we're talking 15, what about one uncle, aunt, cousin, one friend, one neighbor? You see where the numbers are going. But more importantly, say the teacher's been teaching for a while, 5 years, 10 years, maybe they have at least one student that likes them. That's supposed to be a joke, folks. We need far more than that. But one student that likes them. That student brings one parent and one grandparent. We can get to 100+ million in the bat of an eye. I truly believe that. And that's what I've been working towards all this time. And again, watching you guys set the table for the rest of us, get those numbers and show the rest of us how it can be done. And that it can be done. You can get the parents. You can get the teachers. You can get the neighbors. You can get the relatives. As you say, get the other union people involved, which was another thing that I've been preaching. The post office, 5 years ago, was the second largest employer in the country, only behind Walmart, at 2 million that they have. They're ranks have been decimated. They should be natural allies. Look at the other unions. They should be our natural allies. Look at the people, retired teachers, others who Social Security is being threatened every year. Natural allies. Look at Medicare. I can go on and on and on. There is absolutely, in my opinion, and I keep saying my opinion, but it's, you know, I go to the mat on this. There is no reason why we should not be able to get the numbers, because we have them. We should be able to get the numbers that we need, state from state to state, from city to city, to county, to mount a counter war that they have never seen before, to take back our schools and other elements of our society that they've sought so successfully to privatize.
Yes.
And again, I'm just so happy that the two of you were on today and who give us some insight into what's happening there in Chicago. And also, I don't know if you know, but I'm hoping that I get a chance to come to Chicago and do what I've been doing in other states and other cities there in Chicago. I would love to be able to get to Chicago before this school year is over.
That'd be great.
Is the school year over?
End of June.
It should be anytime soon.
Week of June.
Even what's going on, yes. But
depending about the strike issue, though, so we'll see.
Yeah. So it's up on the air a little bit.
Yeah, so it could be June, but it could be also April and May. I get it. But in any event, I'm hoping that I can get there before you guys go out on strike or before the summer session comes and people spread from the city to elsewhere. That would be a highlight for me to be able to come there. So,
absolutely. Please come.
With that in mind, I'll give you the last word, because you have been terrific. I said it to everybody, by the way. You've been terrific. I'll give you the last word. I lie sometimes, but you've been terrific.
Yeah.
Last word, thank you so much for having us on.
Yeah. Thank you so much for highlighting what's happening in Chicago, and we keep your eyes open for April 1st. It should be interesting.
And I'll just end by saying, I think if the working class really starts to move here in Chicago and the rest of the country, who knows where they'll stop. So we're hoping to give a good example this coming Friday.
The two of you, I wish I could be there Friday. I'm back here in Buffalo now. I probably will be here for another X number of days. So then I'm going to be going home. I've been away 2 months. Again, 2 months started in October through almost all of December, I was gone. Then we got back home for about a little over a month. Then I came back out February the 1st. I won't get home until after April 1st. So I wished I could be there, but I can do this. How about next week, the two of you try and come back and talk about what happened April 1st. That I can do.
Okay, yeah. And I'm sure there's tons of folks who will be able to talk about what happened April 1st. So, yeah, absolutely. More than happy.
Certainly, yeah, I would certainly. Hopefully we have stuff to report. But.
Yeah, and maybe we can get Michelle and whoever else we can get to come back and give us, maybe 10, 15 minutes their time to bring us up on how successful it was. You see how I'm predicting the future. So, you guys like that? We can do it.
All right,
sure.
Sounds great.
Okay. Add you to the agenda for next Sunday, folks. For those of you who are listening, we'll get a report from this group next Sunday. And with that, I'm going to say thank you to the both of you, and for the rest of you, including you two, have a nice Sunday. That's it for us now.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.